everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And here in New York, we just had another dusting of snow. This has been quite a white February, and I am really enjoying getting out into it, and it's really been fun. I hope many of you are also enjoying the beautiful white snow. I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Brenda Sanders. She is the founder and executive director of Afro-Vegan Society, and I will tell you more about her in a little bit. But first, I want to talk about things going on in the news and ways that you can take action and, of course, share this week's recipe with you. So first off, I just want to share some of my frustration. I've been trying to find some new health insurance for my family, and I was just convinced, since our income is so much lower this year, that we would qualify for some assistance with health insurance. And so I went on to the open market and, you know, plugged in our information, and voila, we were not entitled to any assistance. And so I went looking at the open market to see what was what, and I was just shocked at the prices of what health insurance is costing. You know, in the past, my husband's business was covering our health insurance, so I didn't pay that much attention to it. But now that we need to pay for it ourselves, I am just completely, utterly shocked at how much it doesn't cover and yet how much it costs. And it is just wrong. I mean, how can someone who is struggling to pay their rent and put food on the table justify paying anywhere between $700 and $1,200 a month for health insurance when most of the time you're not going to the doctor? You know, I remember when I was younger and I didn't have health insurance, my parents insisted I get catastrophe insurance, which was, you know, a huge $5,000 deductible, but it would cover in case, you know, I was struck, you know, with cancer or some other horrible disease. It wouldn't bankrupt them, because my parents knew that, you know, they would step in. And so I had catastrophe insurance, and that was, I remember, pretty cheap. So I asked about catastrophe insurance, and there's no such thing anymore. I mean, catastrophe insurance still costs $650. It's just so unacceptable. I don't know what the answer is. Of course, universal health care would be good, but right now the health costs in this country are just so astronomical. And we have to rein that in somehow. And one of the best ways, I think, would be a start by people making the connection between our food and our health. It's shocking to me that the medical industry has not yet started using food as medicine. I mean, you know, that's the history. You go back to, back to the beginning of medicine, and food was medicine. And, you know, Native Americans knew how to go out into the wilderness and find, you know, white birch bark or, you know, whatever, you know, medicinal plant they could find to make us better. And homeopathy is still a wonderful method, and Chinese herbs are still wonderful. And yet we don't subscribe to those in Western medicine at all. And yet they've been working for many, many, many years. And we need to just relook at things. And yet if you see the connection between medical costs and health insurance and doctors, I mean, I wrote in my newsletter this week, you know, the average salary for a CEO of a healthcare company this year was $18 million. $18 million. Who needs that much money? Meanwhile, one out of every five Americans are struggling to pay off a medical debt that is in threat of putting them into bankruptcy. It is just, you know, such a broken system. And our food system is just as broken. And we really need to, you know, start from the beginning and rebuild our healthcare system based on a healthy diet. The amount of sugar and artificial ingredients that the average American eats is so bad for our health diabetes, all the food related diseases that are responsible for, healthcare in this country being so expensive are preventable by a healthy diet. And I'm sure we'll get into that more with my guest in just a little bit. Of course, in the news, you know, we're dealing with, you know, watching the Senate, courts right now. What's going on in our country is just so hard to put into words, but it's just amazing to me how many of our Republican senators are in denial and will not stand behind, you know, President Trump's horrible behavior. And, you know, it's just unbelievable. But one of the things I wrote about this week, actually, in my newsletter is eco grief and climate anxiety. And, you know, how many people, you know, with a year of being quarantined, you know, or isolated through the pandemic and reading about the planet and climate change, you know, eco grief and climate anxiety is a real cause for depression. And there are therapists that are really starting to specialize in that area. And, you know, what I wrote about was just how many people are falling into a deep state of depression filled with fear and dread. People are trying to make decisions as to whether to have children, and they're scared to have children because as a parent, let's face it, we want to know that we can protect our children. And if so many things are out of our control, like the pandemic and like climate change, it is scary to bring new life into the world when we have so little control of protecting our children. And so it's really a quandary that so many people are struggling with. And, you know, I don't really have any answer, just acknowledging that this is real, that eco distress, and the fear that revolves around it is real. And, you know, meditation and getting out and doing some exercise is really one of the best things. And also giving back to our societies. You know, when we get out of our own struggles and give back to community, that helps us get out of our depression and also work with other people so that you feel like you're a part of a bigger whole. And that really, really is helpful. You know, I didn't put too many things in my newsletter this week about take action other than writing to your senators and letting them know that Tom Vilsack for Secretary of Agriculture is definitely the wrong choice. He was in there with the Obama administration and under his oversight, genetically modified crops were approved at record numbers more than any other secretary. He killed the GMO bill to label, or the bill to get GMOs labeled in Congress. And during his oversight, the USDA was 6 times more likely to foreclose on a black farmer than a white farmer. So he's just not the right person. We need someone that has vision, that can really imagine how our food system could be improved by and help mitigate climate change by adopting more regenerative agricultural practices, and how we need to really build up our local infrastructure so that access to healthy food is more available to everybody. And that, of course, will be better for our health as well. So we need to make sure that Tom Vilsack is not our Secretary of Agriculture. Biden can certainly do better. He is, you know, he has made a commitment to addressing climate change, and this is one area where he really could do better. So I hope I really hope that that is denied, and that he is not going to be the person that is our Secretary of Agriculture. And now I want to share with you this week's recipe. I made a really great stir fry the other day with some crispy tofu, and it's an Asian stir fry. But the thing that was unique about it is, and I do this a lot, while I'm doing my stir fry, I can simultaneously be cooking the tofu in the oven, which saves time, but it also crispens up the tofu and makes it not fall apart when you add it to the stir fry. And I did a breading on top of the tofu with some nutritional yeast that I spiced up, and it makes a really nice coating on the tofu. You use almost no oil. You know, I just sprayed the parchment paper so that the tofu wouldn't stick, but it reduces the amount of oil needed in the stir fry as well. So it's really great. So these are the ingredients you need. You need one block of extra firm tofu that you're going to cut into cubes and lay it out on a dish towel with another dish towel on top and just lightly press it so you're absorbing a lot of the extra water in there. A half a cup of nutritional yeast, a half a teaspoon of garlic powder, a quarter teaspoon of paprika, a quarter teaspoon of onion powder, and a quarter teaspoon of ginger powder. And that's what's going to be the breading for the tofu. So you're going to mix all those up in a little bowl. You're going to cut the tofu up into the cubes, and then you're going to put the tofu cubes into the bowl. But you don't really want to mix it up with your fingers and break apart the tofu. You want to do it really delicately so that the tofu doesn't break up. So what I do is when I put the tofu into the bowl, I then take my spatula and slowly lift and turn the tofu so that the tofu gets completely covered with the nutritional yeast. And then I lay the nutritional yeast out onto a cookie sheet that I've lined with parchment paper. And like I said before, I lightly sprayed the parchment paper just to help it not stick. And I baked that in a 375 oven for about 15 minutes. But I checked, every oven's different. You want to turn the pan around halfway through so that if the back of the oven's hotter, it cooks more evenly. And you also want to turn the tofu cubes over so that both sides get golden brown. The side that's on the parchment paper will turn golden brown first. So halfway through, you want to turn those over. The other ingredients you need is one onion that you're going to cut in half and then slice into crescent moons, two carrots cut into matchsticks, 1.5 tablespoons of grated ginger, 1.5 tablespoons of chopped garlic, one small head of broccolini, or you can use regular broccoli as well, 2 cups of napa cabbage, 2 cups of bok choy, 2 cups of snow peas cut in half, some olive oil for the stir fry, 3 tablespoons of tamari, and you can adjust that to your taste. If you're avoiding salt, you can also use coconut amino acids instead. 2 tablespoons aji marin, which is a sweet rice wine. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil, 1 teaspoon of hot sesame oil, 1 cup of unsalted or lightly salted dry roasted cashews, and 1/4 cup of cilantro. And then to thicken the sauce, I wanted to make a little, instead of using cornstarch, I used tapioca flour. And I made a little slurry with 1 tablespoon of tapioca flour, 1 tablespoon of tamari, 1 tablespoon of cold water, and 1 tablespoon of toasted sesame oil. And I mixed that up, and that I'll put onto the stir fry just a few minutes before the stir fry is finished. And that will thicken up the sauce. So while your tofu is cooking in the oven, you're going to lightly cover the bottom of a wok with oil. When the oil's hot, you're going to add the onions and cook those for a few minutes. Then you're going to add the garlic, the ginger, and the carrots and continue cooking that at medium-high heat, stirring constantly for about another 5 minutes. Then add the broccolini and the napa cabbage. At this point, you can add a little bit of water. You can add like 1 tablespoon of water at a time to continue doing the stir fry. You can also, of course, add oil, but if you're trying to reduce the amount of oil, using 1 tablespoon of water at a time works really well for the stir fry. So that's what I've been doing. So add just a little bit of water and continue stir frying. Then when that starts to get soft, you can add the bok choy and the snow peas. and cook just for a few more minutes. You're going to add the tamari and the aji marin to this. Then you're going to take that slurry that you made with the tapioca flour and pour that over the stir fry. You're going to add the tofu into the wok, and then add an additional half a cup of water to the wok just to make a little bit more sauce and allow that to thicken up. You know, this slurry mixture will start to thicken. You can add the cashews and the cilantro right at the end there. And that's it. You can taste your stir fry. If you like a little more salt, you can add a little more salt. If you want a little more dark sesame oil, you can add that. And the same with the hot chili oil. That's really done by taste. So you can add that as well. And I served it with some brown rice. You can also serve it with some rice noodles or udon noodles if you'd like. And that's it. It cooks up really fast. It's a great midweek meal. You can substitute any vegetables that you have in the house. You don't have to stick with the vegetables that I mentioned in the recipe. You really can be flexible with that. And that's it. And so if you make the recipe, please let me know how you like it. I love hearing from all of you. And now I would like to share with you some more information about Brenda Sanders, my guest this week. She's a real mover and shaker. The amount of things that she's involved with is just amazing. She's a vegan food justice activist in Baltimore City, and she co-founded Thrive Baltimore, which is a community resource center that offers classes, workshops, cooking demos, and other programming that supports people living a healthier, more sustainable lifestyle. She's also the executive director of Afro-Vegan Society, which is a nonprofit organization that provides resources to people in marginalized communities to assist them in transitioning to veganism. In 2012, Vegan Soul Fest was born, and that's another one of Brenda's co-creations. It's an annual festival that celebrates culture and all aspects of vegan living. Lastly, Brenda is the co-owner of The Greener Kitchen, which is a vegan deli and food distributor that produces plant-based foods that are both affordable and accessible. So Brenda, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Ah, my pleasure. Thank you for joining me. So, you know, what inspired me to invite you on was when I was reading about Veguary, your February challenge for people to join on and become vegan. And I really want to talk about that. So maybe we can actually start there. And then I want to hear your story about how you got inspired to become vegan. So maybe you can tell us first about Veguary.
Sure. So Veguary is a vegan pledge program that is being hosted by Afro Vegan Society, the organization, as you said, that I founded and am executive director of. And we just wanted to do something. We started out trying to sort of brainstorm what we could do to sort of commemorate this, you know, this 28 days of celebration of Black history. And we decided that one of the things that we do really well is support people through giving education and resources and, you know, just the tools that people need, to help them on their journey towards living, vegan. And so we thought, well, why not do what we already do, and turn it into a pledge program and just engage people with information about the ways in which, veganism actually has, a history within the Black community and the benefits that living vegan can have to people today.
Uh-huh. And so when did you become vegan?
It's been about 23 years. So it's been a while.
Uh-huh. And what inspired you to become vegan? Did you go straight to becoming vegan, or did you go vegetarian first and then?
Yeah, I wasn't really exposed to a lot of information about vegetarianism or veganism. I just didn't grow up in an environment where that kind of stuff was like being talked about. And so I kind of came across this book, while, you know, in my late teens that, and, you know, people ask me like, what was the book? And to this day, I cannot remember the name, the author, anything, but I know that I was reading the book and it was talking about like the sacred body and, you know, your body being a temple and, you know, like the, and being one with the rest of the planet, like just all these new concepts. And a part of what was being talked about was, not consuming animal products. And for whatever reason, it just resonated with me. And I was like, oh, this seems like a thing I could do. And then I just did it overnight. So, I didn't do it well, but I did it. And, it was actually horrible. Cause I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a natural food store or anything like that. Cause I grew up in the projects, in Baltimore City. And so, you know, but I was always an avid reader. And so, you know, I just kind of did what I could in terms of diet, and I just ate whatever we had, which was not terribly healthy. But over time, I learned more about living vegan and all the different things that are involved with that. And I sort of expanded from there.
I remember when I first became vegetarian, also inspired by reading a book, which was Diet for a Small Planet. I remember that book because it was so important to me. I was 16 at the time. But I went, and I also did it overnight, but I went vegetarian, not vegan. So there was a lot of dairy in the diet, but I remember, saying I went on the white diet, you know, because I also grew up with no vegetables, you know, or just frozen or canned vegetables in my house. And so when I first became vegan, it was, you know, bagels, pasta, potatoes. It was just, everything was white, you know, and then I started learning about other things. You know, so it's a process. Now do you, I know you promote veganism, and yet you also promote healthy veganism, right? Because I have met in my many years of doing this, so many people that are vegan because of animal cruelty, but they really have no connection to improving the health of their diet. They eat, you know, Dunkin' Donuts is vegan, you know, artificial sprinkles are vegan, you know. So can you tell me or share with my listeners how do you promote vegan to be healthy so that it's not just non-animal?
Right. So my work in particular is in, you know, low-income Black communities where there are these huge health disparities that exist. And so it, you know, for me, it can't just be don't eat animal products, because I'm trying to address an issue, a systemic issue that exists within these communities, and people are suffering. And so, you know, I sort of identified eating plant foods as a natural solution to the health issues that folks in my communities were having. And so it just only made sense to promote the healthiest, most life-giving, most vital foods that I possibly could. And so, you know, all of the programming and things that we put together is focused around whole foods, healthy foods, simple foods, affordable foods, that kind of thing. And it's the best possible solution for folks in low-income communities, because a lot of those processed, less healthy plant-based foods are also more expensive. And so it just, you know, promoting a healthy plant-based diet to people who are suffering from chronic illness, chronic food-related illness, just made the most sense.
Well, actually, unfortunately, so often the junk food that is vegan, that is unhealthy, is cheap. That's part of the problem, is very often the bad food is the cheap food. And I think that's partly why we see so many people in marginalized communities with so many poor health issues, because they want to fill their stomachs, and it's the cheapest food is sometimes the most unhealthy food. And so, unfortunately, that's what happens. Absolutely. So how does, food justice come into your work? Cause I know, you know, you talk about food justice and you're an activist, like myself. And so, can you share with us, how that works within, Thrive Baltimore and the Afro-Vegan Society?
Sure. So, I mean, as you know, food justice work is about the, this idea that everyone has the right to be able to access healthy food, right? And there are certain communities that, especially in the U.S., that are certainly targeted with the most unhealthy foods. And I grew up in one of those kinds of communities. And so I saw firsthand in my own life, in the lives of my family members and the whole community around me, how only having access in our communities to these, like, the worst of the worst food products was really just impacting the lives of people generation after generation. And so you would have situations where, like, I thought that when you turned a certain age, just certain things naturally happen. So, you know, when you turn this age, you just have diabetes. When you turn this age, you just have heart problems. And just learning that that wasn't the case, and that, you know, all of these just like chronic illnesses that were just running rampant throughout, you know, our community were food related. You know, it just really hit me very hard. And I started to look at the foods that are being made available, you know, that are being trucked in to these communities and just dumped into, you know, the carryouts and the corner stores and the places where the only places that people in these communities have to go and purchase food items. And it's just the worst of the worst. It's all processed. It's all full of salt, all full of, you know, unhealthy oils and fats and sugar and, you know, all these cheeses and everything and all these canned meats and, you know, and so it's just, it's worse than most people could even imagine unless you actually walk into these places and see what's on the shelf. And this is what we grew up with. And this is what our parents grew up with. And this is what our children are growing up with. And so when you have this situation where generation after generation is specifically being targeted, you know, not only with these processed packaged foods, but also with the fast food restaurants, you know, that come into the community and set up shop. Now you have a recipe for a lot of health issues. And that is exactly what these communities are being faced with.
Mm-hmm. And so in your work, have you been able to make some inroads, and have you seen much change within your communities? Have you been able to close down any of the fast food places? Or I know you have your own deli, your Green Kitchen Deli. Can you maybe talk about that, and how has that helped your community?
Yeah, so when I started out, I had, you know, these grandiose, you know, goals and mission to just, you know, make this amazing plant-based food. And then I would get it into all the carryouts and all the corner stores and all the convenience stores. And it was just going to be, you know, just amazing. And then what ended up happening was that, we learned that it's a whole process. Like, it's not just a matter of if you make it, they will come. Because now you have to re-educate folks, you know, who have been eating a particular way for generations. And so we set out to do that first and foremost, to have all these, like classes and workshops and cooking demos and everything made completely free, because we didn't want anybody to be excluded from being able to get access to this life-saving information. And then the problem arose, you know, where people were we were interacting with all these thousands of people who were like, this is amazing, this food is great, but I can't access it. Like, I can't get, it's not in my community. And so we set out to try to make that happen. But what we found was that the owners of these convenience stores and carryouts and, you know, corner stores and stuff were not open to bringing in these kinds of products. They were completely skeptical. They said, you know, these people in this neighborhood, they're not going to eat this. And I'm not going to waste my money on this. And so we kind of found ourselves, sort of banging our heads against a wall, because it's like, well, we want these foods to be available. People are open to these foods. We're showing and educating them in how to prepare these foods. And yet we are, you know, hitting all these obstacles in getting the foods into their community. So I never wanted to be a store owner. That was not on my agenda of things to do in my life. But since we had so many obstacles to making this happen organically, you know, we just decided to do it ourselves. And so, we started manufacturing, you know, the substitutes, because that was the thing that, like, people were, they were skeptical about, you know, the folks who were coming through our programming and stuff. They were like, no, this food is great. I love all of this, but what about chicken? You know, what about beef? What about, like, I still have to have these things. And we, you know, as much as we wanted to convince people, like, no, you really don't. I mean, this is generations of programming. And so we thought, you know, how can we make convenience food as healthy as humanly possible? So we use real ingredients and real, you know, real foods, even as we're sort of emulating, these products that folks, recognize. And at the same time, we're teaching people to sort of move away from the substitutes and craft meals around whole grains and legumes and, you know, beans and these kinds of things. And so it just, what we've learned is that it's just a whole process of re-education and then providing the resources that people need to be able to make that transition. Have we shut down, you know, the corner stores and the carryouts and such? Not yet. You know, I mean, it's a slow process. It's slow going. And, you know, we don't have access to as many resources as we would like to have to do this work. But we're continuing the work, and we have made a huge, I mean, there are vegan restaurants that are now coming into Baltimore in droves, or at least, you know, before the pandemic, there were, you know, at least 10 vegan restaurants open in Baltimore. And I don't think that that is a coincidence. I think that it's because the culture, like the food culture in Baltimore, is shifting. And that's in large part because of the work that people are doing on the ground.
That's great. Good for you. Let's take a couple minute break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about how COVID has impacted your community and how it's affected your work at Thrive. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Brenda Sanders from the Afro-Vegan Society. Be right back. Ani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest, Brenda Sanders. She's the founder and executive director of Afro-Vegan Society and co-founder of Thrive Baltimore. And right before the break, I was asking her how COVID-19 has affected their work at Thrive Baltimore. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So, tremendously is how, COVID-19 has affected our work. Because all of our work was about bringing people together. So everything that we did, from, you know, the cooking demos to the classes, the workshops, we had just constant programming, food tasting, so that people could actually come in and sample plant-based foods, for the first time. We did film screenings, all kinds of stuff. And, so obviously none of that stuff is on the table right now. And what we have, ended up doing is sort of shifting, away from that. So we put a lot of, the programming onto our online platform, and now we go out into communities and we do, food relief work. And you know, I personally learned so much, the last like 9 months or so of going out and, into communities and, providing plant-based foods through food giveaways with other organizations, because, you know, first of all, I didn't know how bad, people's food situation had gotten once, the economy started to suffer from the pandemic, and so many people got laid off, and so many people, you know, the previous administration had already cut a lot of public assistance. And so people were already struggling in terms of losing food stamp benefits and then getting laid off. They became, you know, it became a desperate situation for so many families. And so going out into communities and, you know, providing, this, delicious, hot, plant-based food, people would line up for blocks. I mean, whole families come out and, you know, they're so grateful for the hot food. And then, like, the other folks who are giving stuff away, a lot of times it's just, like, unhealthy stuff. It's, like, whatever the grocery stores are, you know, willing to just kind of dump off on folks. And so, you know, sometimes it's spoiled food or food that's already expired. I've seen moldy bread. I've seen, you know, expired meats and eggs and stuff like that. And so when we come out there, we are bringing like this delicious, healthy, like nourishing hot food, and people are just so grateful. And you know, we bring hand sanitizer and we bring masks and, you know, just, we try to just be, a resource to the community to sort of pick up some of the slack and alleviate some of the suffering.
Mm-hmm. And so when you do that, are you cooking it in your deli and then bringing it out?
Right.
And so who's funding that? I mean, and how many meals are you giving away?
Yeah. So, initially it was just, we were just using whatever we had on hand. And we would just do, like as many gallons of food as we possibly could at a time. And so, we would feed anywhere from like 60 to 100 families. We've even gotten up to like 150 a few times. And we, you know, once we started to like kind of put it out there that this was something that we were doing, we did get the attention of a couple of, organizations that wanted to help support what we were doing. And so we have gotten some support that way. But you know, it's just a very small, handful of people, because we didn't really feel comfortable asking for volunteers to go out in the middle of a pandemic, you know, it just, and so it's kind of like, we're just doing what we can with what we have.
Mm-hmm. And when you go out into the communities, are people maintaining 6 feet distance? Everyone's wearing masks. How are you distributing it?
Yeah, so.
Or are you dropping it off at people's houses?
Oh, no. No. There are some organizations, that are much more, structured than we are, that are out there with their, you know, with their vans, and they're dropping off to homes. What we have done is, we've partnered with other organizations that were already doing food giveaways, like weekly food giveaways, and we just set up our own table. People are social distancing. When folks don't have a mask, we make sure that, you know, we're able to give them one. And I mean, people, for the most part, the people who I have been engaging with, they are taking the pandemic seriously because it has hit their community really, really hard. And so there's been tons of deaths, tons of illnesses, you know, like people can't afford to not take the pandemic seriously at this point in these communities.
Mm-hmm. So going back to your veguary month, how many signups have you gotten? How large a movement is it?
Yeah, so we have almost 2,000 people who have signed up. Yeah, who have committed to going vegan for the entire month of February. It's very, very exciting. One of the things about transferring our in-person activism over to a virtual platform is that we've been able to reach so many more people with the same kind of quality programming that we were doing before. And folks are just so engaged and so excited, and I'm exhausted because, you know, people are so engaged and so excited. But it's just, it's exhilarating as well to just have, to just know that you're touching the lives of so many people and you're building this awesome community.
Right. And so the veguary program, I signed up. And so, you know, I've been getting daily, morning, info. Can you share with what people will get if they sign up?
Yes. So we wanted it to be a very personalized experience. You know, we miss people. We miss being able to see people and hug people and be around people. And so we want to convey that same feeling, that same like sense of community. And so we are in communication constantly. We are going to send you a daily email. We're going to send you a weekly wrap up email. This is all the stuff that, you know, we've done. If you miss anything, check this stuff out. We are, you know, on our social media platforms all day long engaging with people, putting information out there. We have a Facebook group in which we are, you know, doing constant posting and live videos and, you know, like updates and all kinds of stuff. And so, and even on our website, there's lots of ways to engage with our blog posts and these kinds of things. And so, you know, we just wanted to have a really well-rounded program where everybody felt included and seen. And I really think that that is what we've been able to do.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And have you had any more success in getting some of your products into those corner stores?
So, interestingly, what we have had is success in getting restaurants all over Baltimore to be interested in building out vegan menus with our products. And you know, and so that's a step in the right direction, because these are folks who, prior to finding out about us and finding out about, you know, the meat and dairy and egg substitutes that we make, that, you know, they had nothing. They had nothing available for somebody walking in off the street who's just like, you know, I'm hungry, but I, you know.
Don't eat animal products.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And so now there are so many restaurants across Baltimore that are using our products and that are proud to be using our products.
Oh, that's great. That's
great. I mean, and still the goal is for there to be so much of a demand amongst the people that they will demand of the corner store, we want these products, you know, in your store. And so that's the next step.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, I was on the Suffolk Food Policy Council at one point, and they were trying to get corner stores just to bring in more fresh vegetables. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it started as a pilot program. And trying to just get one corner store to bring in fruits and vegetables, it took a year between, you know, the agreement of the signage and the, you know, all the different things that they needed to work out. It took a year to get vegetables into one corner store as a model. And I just thought, this is not going to work. I mean, if it's going to take this long, you know, and then, I was at a conference, you know, and I met someone who was working with Nestle to bring, or no, Pepsi, I'm sorry, Pepsi. Mm-hmm. And they were contracting to deliver fresh vegetables to all the corner stores where they deliver their Pepsi. And I thought, oh, this is greenwashing, you know, it's like, you know, and yet at the same time, they were able to get fresh vegetables into loads of corner stores all at once because they already had the distribution set up. And
isn't that something?
So it was just kind of like a frustrating thing. I mean, at first when I was at this conference and Pepsi was there to start with, I was like, right. Why am I at this conference? You know, I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And then I saw that they were trying to do something good, and it's, you know, it's always a give and take, you know, it's nothing's just like black and white. And it's, you know, you see how sometimes partnering with, I don't want to call them the devil, but partnering with a company that you think is just horrible. And yet because they have the money and some of the power, they have the ability to make a change that you want to see happen. So, you know, they were willing to do that. And, you know, and now there's some fresh vegetables in the stores while there's the Pepsi is still there. So, but I guess it's still better that there's at least that access to some fresh vegetables. Yeah. So what kind of feedback have you been getting or excitement from your community in this transition? Have you, you know, I assume the movement is growing. You've been around for many years now. You have your big festival. Are you going to be doing a festival this year, the Vegan Soul Fest?
Yeah, that still remains to be seen. You know, we missed out in on being able to host the festival in 2020. In 2019, we had 13,000 people come out, which was, you know, it's just every year it gets bigger and bigger. And so it was heartbreaking to not be able to do Vegan Soul Fest. And, you know, so we've got lots of feedback about that. and everybody, you know, saying how disappointed they were. We are keeping our eyes eyes, you know, peeled, and we are paying attention to what the city restrictions are. And, you know, if later on this year, if things sort of level out and the city starts to open back up again, we'll consider it. But if not, then maybe we'll, you know, just kind of engage with people online in some capacity and then really gear up for 2022. So, yeah. You know, we're just kind of going with the flow and we're gonna see what happens.
Yeah. I'm organizing with my local slow food chapter and the NOFA organization that I'm part of, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. We're having and moving ahead with our CSA fair, our community supported agricultural fair, because we figured it's not something where you get 13,000. I mean, we, you know, last time we had, you know, maybe 120 people come out, but 120 prospective customers for the farmers. And, you know, we figured we're setting it up like a farmer's market. There will be tents there and everybody, you know, we can certainly put the tents, you know, 10 feet apart easily and everyone can wear masks, but still people can come out and shop and, you know, support our local farmers, which is what we want. So, as of right now, we're still moving ahead with that, but we know last year's was canceled because of the pandemic. And yeah, it's really, you know, new ground that we are all on, trying to find our way.
Yep.
So in addition to the, Afro Vegan Society, I'm trying to figure out where the separation is between all the different things you have your hands in, because, you know, or do they all kind of merge into one? You have the Afro Vegan Society, you have Thrive Baltimore, you have Vegan Soul Fest, you have Veduary, you have so many different things going on. How do you keep them all straight?
Sometimes I don't. I've been known to get confused. But yeah, so Thrive Baltimore, is sort of like the gathering space. It's a physical, you know, building. It's a community center. And then, Afro Vegan Society is more the national organization. It's, you know, all of everything is pretty much online at this point, virtual outreach. And then of course the Greener Kitchen is the food side. And it does all sort of, come together under one big, you know, like food justice umbrella. And, you know, each component came about because it was needed, because there was some need that the community had. And we felt like, you know, at least for me, that I needed to, fill that void. And so, yeah, like all these different projects were born. So
is the Greener Kitchen at the Thrive Center? Are they?
No. So the two are in completely different marginalized communities. We were able to actually put the Greener Kitchen in a community in Baltimore called Pigtown, which is really interesting because Pigtown is so named because it was the community where the pigs were ushered, you know, from the train through this community and to the slaughterhouse. And so there's,
oh, you mean actual pigs? Okay.
Yes,
I wasn't sure if you were talking about policemen or,
oh, no. No, nobody was sending police officers to the slaughterhouse, I don't think. But yeah. And so there's this whole history of, you know, killing animals. And then here, you know, we're popping up and we're like, you know, we have no animal products whatsoever as a part of our mission and philosophy. And so it's been really interesting seeing like the culture clash, between, the food businesses that already existed and then the Greener Kitchen and seeing how even the community, has responded. And it's been really, really interesting. They had no idea what we were, what the heck it was about. They were, you know, curious and would pop in from time to time. And then when, you know, and then they were like, oh, no, not meat. Oh, no, thank you. But like, as we coaxed people in and said, well, just taste the food, taste it. Like, you know, try the potato salad. You know, the mayo is that we make is absolutely delicious. It just isn't made with eggs, you know? And so like, as people would try the food, they were sold. I mean, so we have like a cult following in the community itself where we're located. And they are very, very like supportive and almost fanatical about, you know, the food. I just happened to be talking to a UPS driver, about my package. And so I had mentioned that I owned a place, a restaurant, on Main Street in Pigtown. And, you know, it's just this young black guy, you know, probably just 20, you know, and he said, "Oh, you mean the vegan spot?" And I was like, so touched. I was like, "Yes, the vegan spot." And he was like, "Oh man, I love that place." You know, uh-huh. And so we are, you know, like making this impact that may not even be seen, but it's happening. And it's just it's so exciting.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, that's just wonderful. And so, is it self-sustaining? You're able to support yourself through the sales of your food?
That is a very interesting question. And I have never been asked that question. And, so there is this, sort of conflict that exists, you know, between trying to make vegan food affordable, but also pricing it in such a way that we can keep the lights on. And it is just such a delicate balance. I mean, it's almost like trying to balance on a strand of hair. It, you know, one might even conclude that it is impossible to make vegan food, like healthy vegan food, affordable to low income people. And so what we have strived to do, and we're actually going to be restructuring the way that we're, engaging with the community, is to make more foods that people can take home and cook themselves, as opposed to, you know, all the labor and everything that goes into preparing like hot food. And there's just everything that goes into that and the cost of that. We are actually trying to expand, people's access to things like, you know, fresh local produce, to things like, you know, soup mixes and, you know, bulk items and these kinds of things, so that, and along with recipes and cooking demos and all those kinds of things, so that people can actually purchase, you know, if they find the prices of vegan food to be more prohibitive, that they can still purchase products and take them home and cook them for their family and maybe get, you know, a meal for four out of, you know, this money that they spent, as opposed to a meal for one. And so right. That, you know, but that's what we had to learn. We've been learning all these things about like how to make plant-based food affordable and accessible. And it is not easy work. It really isn't.
I mean, you know, I've been a personal chef for many years, and cooking vegan food, it's like, I know, you know, if I have a client who says, you know, we just want a steak tonight, it's like, I feel like I'm cheating. I mean, I don't usually cook meat, but, you know, occasionally for a private client, I will. All you do is you stick it under the broiler. It's like, you know, and there's dinner. It's like instant food, you know, compared to getting a vegan meal on the table. You know, you're going to spend a long time, chopping and cooking and sauteing and, you know, the labor involved in cooking fresh vegetables is much more time consuming than sticking a piece of meat or fish under a broiler. Mm-hmm. And people don't understand that. They think, oh, it's all vegetables. It should be cheap. You know, and the labor is just amazing. And so making it affordable is really a challenge. So the meal kit idea sounds great.
Yeah, we are just trying, you know, our mission is to make plant-based eating accessible to everyone, every single person. And so we are learning, you know, as we go along, how to make that happen.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's great. So, we're almost out of time. Can you share with my listeners how they would find you? I mean, of course, I'll share it on my website too, but if they would like to make a donation towards your organization, which organization shall they donate towards?
Wow. Well, you know, it just depends on, you know, how where they feel motivated, you know, to put their donation, because Afro Vegan Society is doing a whole lot right now because of pandemic conditions. And so, you know, we have like a donate button right on the website, afrovegansociety.org, as well as, you know, at some point, a Thrive Baltimore will reopen and we'll be able to start doing that kind of programming again. And so, you know, we have the donate button over at Thrive Baltimore, thrivebaltimore.org. And then, you know, I have a personal Patreon, that, you know, it's just like a way for people to connect with me, see what I'm doing, and sort of support my activism. And I'm just Brenda Sanders at Patreon. And then, even right now, if people wanted to sponsor the ongoing work that we're doing with Veduary during Black History Month, right there on the Afro Vegan Society page, is the Veduary program and more information about it. And you can actually sponsor an aspect of Veduary. So you can sponsor the panels, or you can sponsor the speakers, or you can sponsor, you know, the cooking demos. And so that's another way that people would be able to support the work.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Brenda, thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you so much for the work you're doing in your communities. It's so needed and it's so monumental and it's just excellent. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this.
Sure. Everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week.